Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
The king is dead. Who takes the throne? His oldest living son. But you have to remember something. Israel was a different kind of monarchy. Who was the king before David? Saul. Who became king after Saul died? It was not Jonathan, nor was it a descendant of Saul. In the monarchy of Israel, it did not follow a strict succession because God determined the next king.
In a typical monarchy, it was the king's son who inherited the throne upon his father's death. But Israel was no typical monarchy. In today's message, Pastor David highlights the transition from the kingdom of David to the kingdom of Solomon and the events surrounding that transition. He notes the uniqueness of the Israelite monarchy. Neither the eldest son of Saul nor the eldest son of David inherited their father's throne. Why? Because God was the one in control of the king's successor. Now, let's join Pastor David for today's edition of Enduring Word.
Okay, we begin tonight in the book of 1 Kings, of course, at chapter 1. And you need to be aware, first of all, that the books of 1 and 2 Kings are really a unit together. Our division between 1 Kings and 2 Kings is an artificial division. As a matter of fact, if you will look upon some certain older translations, I've seen some older Roman Catholic translations that have only one book for 1 Kings. Matter of fact, I've seen some, they call 1 and 2 Samuel together 1 Kings, and 1 and 2 Kings together 2 Kings. So the division between 1 Kings and 2 Kings is fairly artificial. But there is a difference between the books because 1 Kings is mostly made up with David and Solomon and their immediate successors. 2 Kings tends to begin with the ministry of the second of the great prophets, Elisha, but we'll get to that all in due time. Together, the books of 1 and 2 Kings cover about 500 years of Israel's history. And again, we just remind ourselves, the nation of Israel, the people of Israel, started when God chose a man named Abraham and called him out of Babylon. Abraham was a Gentile, idol-worshipping man. When God called him out of Ur of the Chaldees, which is Babylonia, and called him to come over to the promised land, to the land of Canaan. And he told Abraham, I'm going to give you a land, I'm going to make a nation out of you, and through you I will bring a blessing to the entire earth. Well, you have the three patriarchs, Abraham, his son Isaac, and then his son Jacob. And then Jacob had these 12 sons. The sons became a large family, and they went into Egypt, and they stayed in Egypt for 400 years. They went into Egypt as a large family. They came out of Egypt as a nation. Anywhere, the estimates are anywhere from 2 million to 6 million people. And then God brought them into the land of Canaan under the leadership of Moses and Joshua. 400 years were spent during this period of the judges when they had no king ruling over them, but God would just raise up leaders from time to time. And then you have perhaps, I'm going to guess, maybe 100 years covered under the books of 1 and 2 Samuel, which takes you from the point where Israel had no king to the point where Israel's second king, the king David, at the closing part of his reign concerns the end of the book of 2 Samuel. Now, when we come to 1 Kings, David is still on the throne. His reign has not yet ended, but he's an old man. And really, that's the whole feeling of the first many verses of 1 Kings chapter 1. The impression you're supposed to get is, look at how old and weak David is. Look here, verse 1. Now, King David was old, advanced in years, and they put covers on him, but he could not get warm. Therefore, his servants said to him, let a young woman, a virgin, be sought for our lord the king, and let her stand before the king, and let her care for him, and let her lie in your bosom, that our lord the king may be warm. They sought for a lovely young woman throughout all the territory of Israel and found Abishag the Shunammite and brought her to the king. The young woman was very lovely, and she cared for the king and served him, but the king did not know her. And so David is old. He's very advanced in years. This is what we might consider to be the twilight, the evening of a long, glorious reign. But the impression you're supposed to get from these first four verses is that David is so old, he can't rule a nation. He can't even keep himself warm in bed. Of course, he cannot rule a nation. Now, what's interesting is that David was not remarkably old at this time. Do you know how old David was about this time? About 70 years old, which is old, but it's not unbelievably old. I mean, when you consider that Moses didn't even really begin his ministry until he was 80, and how long Abraham lived, and how long many of the patriarchs lived, what you have to understand about the life of David is it wasn't just the years. It was how intensely he lived. He lived, what seems to me, he lived the lives of about four or five men within the span of his one lifetime. I mean, his life was lived with a unique intensity from his young days even to this point. And so it's not so much that it's just that he's 70 years old. He's worn out. I mean, he's done. He's about finished here. And so his aides, his advisors around him say, listen, keep the king warm, bring, now you have to admit, this sounds strange, maybe even immoral to us, doesn't this? We've been running across things like this, you know, on Sunday talking about the book of Ruth and things that sound strange in our ears today. And then this, we read about this and, you know, well, here's the prescription for David. Bring a good looking young woman into his bed and that will warm him up. And it sounds like that's a sure funny prescription there. It sounds strange, maybe even immoral to us. But I want you to know, and it's interesting, when you do the research, you'll find some people say, oh, this was sin on David's part. And I have to say, I don't think so. And I think, as a matter of fact, it was proper of David to allow this. And I don't think it brought a moral cloud over the last days of his reign. You know, when you do a little bit of research on this, you understand that this was actually a recognized medical treatment in the ancient world. There's a very famous ancient Greek doctor named Galen, and we have some of his writings today, and he lists medicinal practices and things that you can do. He says, actually, that this is a prescription. This is actually a medical treatment that one can follow when someone is afflicted with this inability to stay warm. And when Josephus relates this story in his own history called The Antiquities of the Jews, he says that this was a medical treatment that David had. As a matter of fact, when he calls the servants of verse 2, where it says, therefore his servants said to him, Josephus calls those servants doctors or physicians. This was an approved medical treatment for David to follow. But it was also proper for David to do this because he almost certainly made this young woman his concubine. Do you understand what a concubine is? There's a difference between a wife and a concubine in the law system of ancient Israel. A wife was a legal partner that you were joined to in marriage, and a concubine was a legal partner that you were joined to. A concubine was not a mistress. It was not a lover on the side. You had a legal commitment to a concubine. The difference between a wife and a concubine, the concubine did not share in the inheritance. And the concubine's children did not share in the inheritance. So there was a very different status, but it was a legal thing to take a concubine. Now, I think it was unwise for David to have more than one wife. And I think his life story and the life story of his descendants after that prove that. But it was not at all illegal according to the law of Israel, or it was not also specifically prohibited by God. Now, later on, I'm going to get a little bit ahead of ourselves in this chapter. Later on, one of David's sons, Adonijah, he's going to condemn himself to death because he asks for this young woman to be taken to himself as a concubine. Now, that would not be such an offense unless she was already David's concubine before. And so I want you to see that David had a legal approved relationship with this young woman. And so they chose someone who was eligible for marriage or concubinage. She was a virgin, and she was also a lovely young woman. I mean, if you're going to have a young woman in the bed with David to keep him warm, she may as well be pretty. And so they did this. Now, one thing I got to say more about this that's very interesting is her name. It calls her there in verse 3, Abishag the Shunammite, and brought her to the king. Now, what's very interesting about this is even from ancient times, many people have wanted to associate this beautiful young woman with another beautiful young woman. Okay, keep your finger here. Turn to the Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 13. Do you know what the woman of the Song of Solomon is known as, what she is? She's called, again, Song of Solomon, chapter 6, verse 13, the Shulamite. And many people have wanted to say Shunammite, Shulamite. It's the same woman. And they say, oh, you know, this was David's concubine. He never had sexual relations with her, but he was a legal companion of her. And then Solomon took her as a wife later on, and they had this beautiful love relationship. You want to know what's hard about believing that? Is that even though to our ears, Shulamite and Shunammite sound the same, they're just plain different words. They're different places. You know, it's like saying somebody from Gießen and somebody from Geisweid, they must be from the same place. Well, there's some similarity to how they sound, but really not much. And so Shunem is not the same as Shulam. It's just not the same place. And it's like kind of twisting the text to try to make them the same thing. There's really no great need to identify this woman as the woman that Solomon later sang to in this book, the Song of Solomon. But what is very plain from this is what we see at the very end verse there, verse 4. The young woman was very lovely, and she cared for the king. Listen, David is in such a bad place here that he needs to be taken care of by a young woman. And because of this, we can see that he has to have a successor. This is the big question that we're supposed to ask at the end of verse 4. David's life is almost over. Who is going to take his reign after him? And so then we come in here to verse 5. Then Adoniah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Now, right away when you read that, you get a bad feeling about that, don't you? Anytime you read in the Bible about somebody exalting themselves, it gives you a bad feeling, doesn't it? But then when you look at this, it's even worse. If you were to go back to 2 Samuel chapter 3, and you don't need to, I'll just describe it to you. 2 Samuel chapter 3 describes the sons of David. It lists the sons of David. It lists Adoniah as the fourth son in the family of David. Now, what happened to the first three sons? Well, the first two sons were dead, Amnon and Absalom. Those two were dead already at this time. There's a third son named Chileab. To be honest, we don't know what became of him. Many people think that maybe for some reason he died accidentally, or maybe there was something about him that just made him unfit to be the next king of Israel. All we know is that he's mentioned once and then never again. The fourth son is this man named Adoniah. And so this man, Adoniah, seems to have been the oldest living son of David at this time. Now, naturally, he would take the throne, right? Isn't that how it works in a monarchy? The king is dead. Who takes the throne? His oldest living son. But you have to remember something. Israel was a different kind of monarchy. Who was the king before David? Saul. Who became king after Saul died? It was not Jonathan, nor was it a descendant of Saul. In the monarchy of Israel, it did not follow a strict succession because God determined the next king. It wasn't just strictly all about who was next in line. You've seen these things, haven't you? You know, these charts of royalty where you have, you know, the Queen of England, let's say, and then you have, you know, her immediate successor, and then the next one in line, and the next one in line, and then they have, you know, the person who's 20th in line, and then 30th in line. They have this whole elaborate thing, and it's very set up, and it's very established. It wasn't like that in Israel. Yes, there was a natural expectation that the oldest son would take the throne, but it wasn't a law. Adonijah, he broke one of the fundamental laws of God in that he refused to let God exalt him. He wanted to exalt himself. And so notice what he did in verse 5. It says, he prepared for himself chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. Now, you know how it is today when a president or the chancellor or somebody is going, they always have what they call a motorcade, where they have the limousines and this big long line and the security vehicles and the motorcycle, you know, policemen and all of that. It's this whole big long procession. Well, this was the ancient version of the motorcade. Adonai is saying, I'm important now. I'm the guy who's in charge. I'm going to take the throne. And so basically, he said, I'm going to take and start putting forth the image of a king. He hoped that if he put forth the image of a king, then other people would start to accept the reality that he was the next king. But look at verse 6. And his father had not rebuked him at any time, saying, why have you done so? He was also very good looking. His mother had borne him after Absalom. Now, it's sad for us to say that as great of a man of God that David was, and you have to say, David is one of the great men of God in the Bible. He was the greatest king of Israel apart from the Messiah. David, as great as he was as a man of God, he was somewhat of a failure as a father. He didn't do a very good job raising his own sons. He failed to restrain his passions in his own life, but then he also showed that he could not restrain his sons or their passions. And so we find this to be true of Adonijah. I think it's kind of interesting, and I don't want to get too psychological here or pretend that we can know things that we don't know about David. But I would suggest to you that David did not have a very good relationship with his own father. In 1 Samuel chapter 16, when we first are introduced to David, David's father doesn't seem to think very much of him. He just says, oh yeah, there's one more out in the field. And he doesn't even mention David by name. David isn't invited to this feast where Samuel and everybody else is. But I think that would be too little to go on, except for, do you understand that in all of David's writings, in all of his Psalms, he really doesn't talk about his father much. Twice he mentions his mother. And twice he mentions his mother as the maidservant of the Lord. And about her spiritual influence upon him. I don't want to, you know, build too much out of this, but if I had to guess, I would say that David's mother was the one who had the spiritual influence on his life. And that David, maybe it wasn't a bad relationship, but it doesn't seem to have been such a great relationship with his own son. But listen, even if that's the case, it does not excuse David's own failures as a father. You know, it would be easy to say, well, of course David couldn't be a good father. Perhaps he did not have a good father. But let me tell you something. Even if you never had a good earthly father, the truth of the matter is you do have a good heavenly father. You have a great example as a father. Even if you did not have a great example of a father on earth, you have a great example of a father in heaven. And you can pattern your life and your fathering, your parenting skills after his. And so we don't know very much about Adonijah other than he was not restrained. It says that David had not rebuked him at any time. We also know from verse 6 that he was very good looking. It doesn't surprise us that David's children were good looking. He seems to have been somewhat good looking. He obviously married beautiful women. And, you know, his own children were good looking. Now, verse 7. Then he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they followed and helped Adonijah. But Zadok the priest, Benaniah the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, Rai, and the mighty men who belonged to David were not with Adoniah. And Adoniah sacrificed sheep and oxen and fattened cattle by the stone of Zoleth, which is by En-Rogel. And he also invited all his brothers, the king's sons, and all the men of Judah, the king's servants. But he did not invite Nathan the prophet, Benaniah, the mighty men, or Solomon his brothers. Okay, Adoniah is making his plans to secure the throne of Israel to himself. And so what he did was he tried to throw a party that would establish him as the king of Israel, but he did it in a way that he invited some people, but he did not invite some other people who he knew were not loyal to him. Like, look, first of all, who he did invite here. Verse 7, it says, then he conferred with Joab, the son of Zeruiah. Do you remember that name, Joab, from the life of David? I personally find Joab to be one of the most complicated and fascinating people in the Old Testament. He is a influential, but a strange man. Joab was David's chief general. He was his number one military guy. And Joab was fiercely loyal to David. But he was not necessarily obedient to David. It's sort of a strange mixture. Joab would die for David, but if he thought David had made a wrong decision, Joab would go against David in a minute and say, I'm going to not do what David said because I think it's better for David that I don't do what he said. A strange man. Sometimes it seems like he's working for David. Sometimes it seems like he's working against him. A very complicated man. I have to say, it's very sad to see Joab doing this here. Because this was not the will of David. It was not the will of David that Adoniah replace him on the throne. But Joab is putting his support behind Adoniah. And it's sad to see this once trusted associate of David turning against him late in his life. So there were many people who did not support Adoniah here. It mentions specifically here in these verses, Zadok the priest, verse 8, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, Shimei, these other people. There were many prominent people in Israel who did not support Adoniah. And so they were going to have a sacrifice unto the Lord. They were going to have a dinner. Adoniah wanted to honor and bless his supporters and strengthen his claim to the throne of Israel. So as we end with verse 10 right there, you kind of say, well, it looks like Adoniah is going to be the next king, right? Well, look at verse 11. So Nathan spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, saying, have you not heard that Adoniah, the son of Haggith, has become king and David, our Lord, does not know it? Come, please, let me now give you advice that you may save your own life and the life of your son Solomon. Go immediately to King David and say to him, did you not, my lord, O king, swear to your maidservant, saying, assuredly your son Solomon shall reign after me, and he shall sit on my throne. Why then has Adoniah become king? Then, while you are still talking there with the king, I will come in after you and confirm your words. Now, this shows us something. First of all, it shows us David already had a plan for who was going to be the king after him, right? David had already said, I want Solomon to be the next king.
Thanks so much for joining us today for this edition of Enduring Word Radio. Over the years in Christian media, we've seen all sorts of misrepresentations about supporting ministries. Everything from give your last dollar to if you don't give, God's work won't be done. These sorts of manipulations are not biblical, and they do not represent God's heart for giving. Here at Enduring Word Radio, we want to run fast and far from these sorts of misrepresentations. That said, it's also important for us to be faithful to share with you the ongoing financial needs that we do have. Enduring Word Radio is heard all over the United States. The program that you listen to today was professionally produced, and purchasing time on some radio stations comes with a cost. So we want to be sure to at least inform you and ask that you seek the Lord about supporting Enduring Word Radio. There's a secure option to give right on the homepage of enduringword.com. You can give a one-time gift or partner with us on a monthly basis. Again, that secure option to support Enduring Word Radio is available at enduringword.com. In closing, our thoughts on ministry is where God guides, God provides. God is faithful, and He will continue to provide for Enduring Word Radio. Again, thanks so much for joining us today for Enduring Word Radio with Pastor David Guzik. It's our hope and prayer that today's message has been a blessing to you. Until next time, may God bless you and keep you.